hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real, let's get loud in America Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Well, welcome to the show this week. We're going to continue our continued mission to bring you truth regarding COVID-19 and the global pandemic. It's important that there's updates every single week, and it's important to bring them forward. A couple updates. One from the World Health Organization, June 25th, announced that they are no longer recommending asymptomatic screening. When there's asymptomatic screening or testing done with a nasal PCR or the nasal or oral antigen tests in asymptomatic individuals, it can only generate false positive tests in about 90% of cases. And even those who are detected to be positive cannot spread the virus. That's been worked out with prior studies. There's basically little or no asymptomatic spread of disease, so it makes no sense at all to test people who are asymptomatic. That means all the testing done at travel, at borders, at sports games, and in dormitories, all of that was completely and totally unnecessary. In the United States, we've had about 34 million cases. We've done testing in over 400 million case examples. And so this was a total waste of time. Please do not, if you're listening to this and you're an administrator and in a position of authority, do not undertake any more asymptomatic testing. It was never approved by the US FDA or any regulatory agency with respect to a reasonable use of the test. The tests are only cleared by the FDA as diagnostic aids to aid in the diagnosis of SARS-CoV-2 infection or COVID-19. The second big update is that we have a torrent of information with respect to mutant strains. And we now understand that the variants have been renamed. Alpha is the UK variant. That was the dominant variant that we had for the longest time here. Beta is the South African variant, which we had little in the United States. Gamma is the Brazilian variant. Unfortunately, we've had relatively little of that. And now Delta is the Indian variant. Far and away, that's the dominant variant in the United Kingdom. It's now just emerging as the dominant variant in the United States. And then we have the Lambda variant out of Peru, and then the Epsilon variant out of California. All of these variants start out actually in the population, and they've been there for a long time, but at a low level. And then something prompts them to become the emergent strain. Most of the time, it's vaccination. And an analysis by Neeson and colleagues from Mayo Clinic and in Boston, they show that once the vaccine rate gets over 25%, then that is the inflection point for one of these mutant strains to take off and become dominant. So we have Delta. Whether we like it or not, Delta appears to be one of the mildest forms. The spike protein has altered itself to escape the antibodies of Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J. We know that because of the 90,000 Delta cases in the United Kingdom, 42% have been fully vaccinated. And we see more and more evidence. The same is true in Israel. From the Israeli health minister has basically indicated that 40% of the Delta cases were previously vaccinated. We have reports now from the HMS Queen Elizabeth. That is a large naval ship, 3,700 crew members vaccinated, and they were strictly tested before they got on the boat. 100 cases have been reported. So it's clear that these individuals can actually carry the virus or develop the virus with contact with one another and, in fact, develop COVID-19. Another example, Houston wedding demanded everybody be vaccinated. 6 Delta cases come about as a result of the wedding. So it's either vaccinated people come in contact with others and get the virus, showing the vaccine doesn't work, or they actually carry the virus and they give it to other vaccinated people, again, showing that the vaccines fail. But it's becoming fundamentally clear when we put together all the clinical information and then supplement it with basic science and preclinical science information showing that every time the SARS-CoV-2 virus mutates, it's having more and more mutations at each change in strain level. and the spike protein becomes less and less neutralized by the antibodies. In fact, the spike protein is becoming smaller because it's, in a sense, dodging these larger antibodies. And there's a wonderful analysis published showing a picture of how the spike protein is changing and mutating over time to escape the relatively narrow antibodies from the current COVID-19 vaccine. So we're 6 months into the vaccine program. It looks like the vaccines basically don't work anymore. They no longer work, and we know that they can't be clinically effective because patients are indeed getting the COVID-19 illness. So we are having a rise. 46 states in the United States are currently on the rise, and I've told America this on several occasions, that we're going to get a rise in COVID-19. It's going to be a small rise from a low baseline, but it is the Delta variant, and it looks like it's happening in those who've been vaccinated. Now, that's not what you're going to hear on the mainstream media because of some intentional manipulation of data by the Centers for Disease Control. At the end of May, the CDC was absolutely overwhelmed with vaccine failure cases. They had over 10,000 well-characterized cases at the end of May, and they gave up on tracking COVID-19 in those who had been vaccinated. So we are not going to see any data from the CDC about vaccinated patients getting COVID because they are assuming vaccinated patients cannot get COVID, and they're only going to be reporting the COVID story on those unvaccinated. So we're already seeing false reports saying that the unvaccinated now, that 99% of all COVID comes from the unvaccinated. It's not true, and it's actually just, that's just a product of manipulated data reporting. So I've been active out there in the news. I've been on the Ingram Angle as a regular contributor, on with Dr. Drew, recently on with Naomi Wolf. I'm doing everything I can with a relatively small group of doctors to try to get the word out that something is really wrong and our agencies are committing malfeasance. That's wrongdoing in a position of authority. And our agencies are committing and driving what's called propaganda. Propaganda is false information that's put out there by people in positions of authority. This is greatly disturbing. It's all designed to promote a needle in every arm and to promote mass vaccination. The vaccination itself is disturbing because the vaccines are genetic gene transfer platforms that no one really would want in their bodies, in my view. And they may, in fact, do way more than just try to be a vaccine against COVID-19. No one knows, but we're becoming more suspicious every day as the vaccines are clearly not safe and clearly not effective. As we sit here today, there's over 9,100 certified deaths that occur after the vaccine. 50% occur within 48 hours, 80% occur within a week. They are strongly associated with the administration of the vaccine. An analysis by McLachlan and colleagues out of London demonstrated that 86% of the time the vaccine actually caused the death or caused the myocardial injury. We have an analysis by Rose et al. That indicates that of the non-fatal events, they tend to occur more in younger people, and they include myocarditis, they include thrombotic events, hematologic events, and immunologic events. The FDA has official warnings now on Pfizer and Moderna for myocarditis or heart inflammation that can lead to heart failure and cardiac death. The CDC has seen thousands of cases, and now the FDA has official warnings on Johnson & Johnson, not only for blood clots or thrombosis in women ages 18 to 48, but now Guillain-Barré syndrome or paralysis that starts in the legs and moves their way up. These vaccines appear to be nothing short of a biologic horror show as they are being described to you. And I'm just giving you the official warnings and the official data as they are coming from our agencies. We're 6 months into this, and none of our agencies have given a press briefing on overall safety. Can you imagine the largest mass vaccination program in the history of the United States and the world, and there is no briefing on product safety? This should be at the bare minimum of a month. The program should have an external critical event committee, an external data safety monitoring board, and human ethics committee. There should be thorough reporting of safety to the U.S. public at least on a monthly basis. And presentation, when people volunteer for the program, presentation of fair balance of safety and efficacy information. None of that's being provided. People are told to go get the shot with no warnings on safety. and without any consideration to their lives or the injuries that we're seeing to date. I'm going to spend some time on the first segment with Daniel O'Connor, who's the overall founder and principal of TrialSite News. And this is a very important resource for you to consider. TrialSite News is completely independent. It cannot be deplatformed. It is not participating with the Trusted News Initiative. That means it's not going to censor information on early treatment or vaccine safety or efficacy. All the articles expertly written, the graphics are terrific, and everything cited. TrialSite News, very important, not only for the general public, but also for pharmaceutical companies, others in pharmaceutical regulation. Everyone's trying to get to the truth as we're off the rails with respect to the NIH, the CDC, and the US FDA, and the vaccine program, which is basically turning out to be a modern American medical catastrophe. The second guest is Dr. Sam White, and I think you're going to enjoy Sam White. He's a young man. He's a concerned physician in the United Kingdom, and Sam White is going to tell his story of what happened when he started to help patients with COVID-19 and started to speak out regarding his current concerns with respect to vaccine safety. So we're going to hear from Sam White and the path forward for the United Kingdom, where things are much worse than the United States. The current vaccination rate in the United States of fully vaccinated is 48%. It's fully 78% rate in the United Kingdom. And it varies from country to country. Germany, it's about 30%. Japan, 18%. Very skeptical in Japan on the COVID-19 vaccine program. The Japanese have been slow to approve these agents as emergency measures and also equally slow to embrace vaccination. They have an elderly population, and look for Japan to show some leadership here on what to do with vaccination. Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm here today with Daniel O'Connor. Daniel O'Connor, he went to undergraduate at the San Francisco State University and received his bachelor's degree. He went on to UCLA and received a master's degree, and then on to the University of California School of Law and received his JD, or his law degree. And then he launched his career in investment banking originally and moved into a really key area in medicine called regulatory science, where he learned the interface between pharmaceutical manufacturers, clinical trials, patients engaged in clinical trials, the information technology that's evolved. And he's come with an innovative solution that we really need here in the pandemic. It's called TrialSite News. Daniel, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. TrialSite News, I'll explain it briefly. It is an online media platform, social network, the first of its kind, dedicated to breaking clinical research, clinical trial news, condensed and made more easily digestible for a wider audience, with the goal of providing, you know, cutting edge, real-time news, empowering more people about what research is unfolding out there around the world, with an eye for accessibility and transparency. We think it's very important that, we're consumers of healthcare, and we need to know, you know, what's in the pipeline in terms of future therapies, products. What are the risks? What are the opportunities? And with that knowledge comes empowerment and hopefully trust and more engagement with research. So that was the original premise.
Well, here you are with COVID-19 now. So TrialSite News, in addition to all its clinical trial infrastructure, has been a really go-to place for late-breaking science, opinions, and reviews with respect to the pandemic. And with the really censorship and crushing fists against scientific advancement that we see in Twitter, YouTube, and social media, Facebook, readers and people who just want to find out what's going on are going to TrialSite News. What do you think are the top five stories in TrialSite News in the last year?
Yeah, it's an important point. So again, we try to stay very balanced and focused and objective as much as we can. And we try to provide multiple viewpoints, which is very important. People, there's a lot of what I call camps out there. So you know, what's really been heavily trafficked has been articles about repurposed drugs. So we've chronicled a lot of studies about drugs like ivermectin. And as everybody knows, in Twitter and some of these social media, they censor that. So, you know, we provide true information about studies, the results, what's going on in other governments, other countries. I would say, so repurposed drugs, I would say vaccine safety. You know, we provide stories, good or ugly, about vaccines. And so we find that there's stories that maybe provide a critical view get heavily visited. We also have a lot of traffic, you know, around research sites. So when we write about goings on about big research centers, we have a lot of traffic from pharmaceutical companies and competitors, different academic medical centers that come to us every day. Our website is visited by every major pharmaceutical company, every major academic medical center, the FDA, NIH, they're at our website almost every day. So plus doctors and the public.
Well, that's terrific. So I think the listeners really ought to key in on Trial Site News. The other thing I'd say is that the layout of the stories and the articles is excellent. The graphics are excellent and the references are excellent. This is when people go on the internet, this is what people are trying to find out. They're trying to get some fair information on vaccine safety or some fair information on the treatment of COVID-19 or how to get involved in a clinical trial. So I think it's been a brilliant stroke that you've hit it just right. And in this day and age, actually without censorship, you probably wouldn't have such a focus, but censorship has actually driven people to try to find out what's going on. And when I talked to people all over, they said, boy, this doctor got censored and got kicked off of Twitter and Facebook. Then people want to follow that person because they know that they're actually probably right on track with respect to the science. The people not getting censored are the ones that are not anchored in scientific underpinnings and are certainly not advancing the field going forward. There is a narrative, and those who follow the narrative are staying on social media platforms, but they really have nothing to say. And it's those that really are going to Trial Site News. One of the early things that I published was about immunity. I was very interested in natural immunity. And I made the prediction before it all started that natural immunity would be better than the vaccine immunity. And sure enough, that's come to pass. Daniel, do you have any final comments for our listeners on the McCullough Report?
Yes, I would say that, you know, when you're going out and seeking information, check out multiple sources. I think the truth always, there's always different vantage points, but you want to be able to, you know, get as many diverse sources as possible and, you know, with credible references. And, you know, we welcome your visits. And we also thank you, Dr. McCullough, for the time here.
Well, terrific. Well, I'll let that be the last word. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. Are you tired of your tired vitamins? Consider Healthy Cell. These are pill-free vitamins that are in convenient gel packs. I like the Focus and Recall supplement. I use this a lot. You know, your brain uses a lot of energy and it depends on a variety of micronutrients and vitamins. Boost your short-term focus and long-term brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus and Recall vitamins. So go to healthycell.com, use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD for a 20% off your first order of any Healthy Cell product. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is McCullough Report.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology, designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the show another guest from across the pond. It's a great, great honor to have Dr. Sam White. Dr. White trained in medicine at the University of Cardiff in Wales, College of Medicine there. He went on to have postgraduate training in both surgery and family medicine at the university there in Cardiff. He is certified by the Royal College there in England, or in the National Health Service, as a general practitioner. He now practices in Hampshire, which is on the south coast of England. And he's been a real leader in the COVID-19 response, has important information from his perspective as someone who's a doctor in the United Kingdom with respect to the pandemic, and comments with respect to testing, early treatment, vaccines, and then the physicians, a really difficult role now in terms of professionalism in our society. So Dr. White, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be with you, Dr. McCullough. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's have you give us just a few comments regarding testing. What is the fundamental problem with the approach to testing as it, you know, has existed through the pandemic and where we are now?
Yes. So I think it's arguable whether we indeed do actually have a pandemic or whether we actually have a PCR pandemic. Okay. So never before in medicine have we considered a diagnosis purely based on a test, which is essentially a fraudulent test when used for this purpose. Okay. So the majority of tests done in this country combine no element of clinical assessment of a patient. Okay. So this kind of breaks every kind of tenet, if you like, of medical practice, where we're saying to someone, you're sick, you've got to stay in your house, yet you have perhaps no symptoms. And in the meantime, you can't go to work, you can't engage in any aspect of your life for the next 10 to 14 days. And same might be true of your family members. Okay. The very inventor of the test, as you know, Dr. McCullough, warned against using the test in this kind of scenario for a pandemic and for infectious disease.
Well, you know, as you know, in the United States, the tests are only strictly approved as a diagnostic aid in acutely sick patients with suspected SARS-CoV-2 infection. So yeah. Our FDA has actually never approved them for asymptomatic testing. Is that what you're talking about? Is the widespread inappropriate use for asymptomatic testing?
Exactly. Yeah. So what I call indiscriminate testing. So people can have this drive-through testing. If you work, for instance, in the health service or you're a teacher, you have to submit to a twice weekly lateral flow test. And as you know, that doesn't test for COVID either. It tests for what we come to know as the N protein. If that happens to be positive, even if you don't have symptoms, you are then required, as by mandate, to submit yourself to a PCR. Okay. So this is still talking about people who could have no symptoms whatsoever.
Well, it's important. Yeah, it's important to understand that the whole principle of asymptomatic testing, again, this has never been approved by regulatory agencies, was really built on a false understanding that the virus could spread asymptomatically. And there's two very good papers, one by Cao, over 10 million people in China, and one by Madewell, published in very good journals, showing asymptomatic spread basically doesn't happen. And so the FDA, at least in the United States, and I imagine MHRA in England, were right originally. They were right that tests should be strictly used only in acutely asymptomatic patients. Now we move fast forward to June 25th of this year. Now even the WHO says, stop the asymptomatic testing.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that message has necessarily reached here, and certainly it hasn't for the lateral flow tests, which are still being enforced and mandated upon. If you wish to leave the country in any way. And it's very difficult to do so from the UK at the moment. You have to submit yourself for a PCR test. And as you know, that could quite easily come back positive, and you have no evidence of SARS-CoV-2, and you can't go on holiday or you can't go on your business trip based on that. Okay. So it's literally limiting every aspect of people's lives.
Right, right. But the important point is many listeners to the McCullough Report are administrators, there's leaders and other people, and they need to hear the world that WHO is telling us as of June 25th, drop the asymptomatic testing. Yeah. I know at the U.S.-Canadian border, they did drop the asymptomatic testing because my wife had just gone through it prior to this June 25th, and she was subject to multiple asymptomatic tests that were completely unnecessary because she was COVID recovered and completely immune. Then she was subject to an unnecessary 14-day quarantine period, and she was just trying to see a sick person in her family in the hospital. And then the next week, her sister came across the border and they had just dropped the asymptomatic testing completely. She went right through. So, you know, we have to spread the word that asymptomatic testing is out. It was never supported. All it did was generate lots of false positive tests. Do you know, in the United States, we've had basically between 1% and 2% of our country actually get COVID-19 by positive testing. And do you know that we have actually performed over 400 million tests? So we have tested the entire population once over for a less than 1% yield.
Yeah. And the same has been replicated here if we add into that the lateral flow tests as well. So far more tests than there are people in the country. Absolutely ludicrous and fraudulent as well at the same time.
Right. So it's really been a real setback, all this asymptomatic testing. Let's move into early treatment. And I know you've been an innovator with early treatment. Have you found that COVID-19 as an illness in high-risk people, older seniors with medical problems, have you found it to be a treatable problem?
I go as far as to say this is far more treatable than influenza, okay, because of the available treatments. The biggest problem we have in this country is that we don't have, as doctors, perhaps the same level of autonomy that you do because of us having a socialized system of healthcare. Okay. So in my video, I raised key treatments which could be used, including HCQ, ivermectin, and budesonide. And I don't know if you know, but the NHS suspended me on the basis of the contents of my video. Okay, so they do not want people to know that there are proven, effective, safe treatments available. We have far greater propaganda issues in this country. It comes from the mainstream media, but also the government and the NHS. So the leaflets that are put through people's door tell them that the best way to protect themselves is with the vaccine. They don't tell them, as an informed consent process would do, that there are alternative treatments and no doctor in this country is allowed to prescribe them.
Well, hang on a second. Didn't you, in the course of your practice, prescribe hydroxychloroquine for rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus, for Sicca syndrome, for malaria prophylaxis?
Absolutely. And I know I've used it for years. I know it to be safe. But as soon as the pandemic was announced, and I think it was shortly around the time that Trump, President Trump announced that HCQ was effective, the MHRA limited the distribution of HCQ under the guise of protecting the supply for patients with rheumatoid. Now, as you know, it's not a first-line drug for rheumatoid arthritis, certainly not in this country. If you can spend billions and billions on an experimental vaccine, you can easily put into production an off-patent, cheap medication available for all.
In fact, the worldwide flow of hydroxychloroquine is so substantial that there would never, ever be a shortage for anyone. The distribution networks and the number of manufacturers are so robust. In fact, many countries stockpiled it. But how about ivermectin? Haven't you used ivermectin for scabies and for worms and other types of illnesses?
Exactly. But the issue we would have in this country, currently ivermectin is what's called a special order. Okay, so that makes it extremely expensive to prescribe in this country, despite the fact that one tablet should merely cost around $3. Okay, now we have a research organization called BIRD, the British Ivermectin Research Development Team. They have done a huge systematic review of all of the data. And as you know, some of the trials was for ivermectin were stopped early because it was deemed unethical to continue with a controlled, untreated group, okay? But what our government has done is said, oh, well, we need to do another study and another study. And they deliberately set the study design up so that it will fail, much like we saw with HCQ last year in The Lancet and JAMA.
Well, you know, right now the listeners should understand that we're at about 60 supportive studies with ivermectin, reduces mortality on the inpatient and outpatient basis. And we have about 200 studies with hydroxychloroquine, much stronger impact outpatient because it's a little slower to work. And there are supportive data inpatients if it started early. So we actually have a massive evidence base that can't be overturned with a one tiny little trial that has physician assigned endpoints. I've never believed that. And, you know, I have to tell you, and the listeners know this, I'm probably the most experienced with clinical data right now of any physician in the world. I've chaired more data set through monitoring boards. I've published the first breakthrough protocols on this ahead of anyone, mainly because I had the publication power and the authority to do it. So I'm here to tell the listeners and support Dr. White that these drugs are safe and effective, but you know, they're not needed, believe it or not. The hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin are so controversial that both Dr. Barrentos in South America and Dr. Chetty in South Africa have innovated with programs where they actually don't use hydroxyivermectin. They move down to the next level. And as you indicated, inhaled budesonide, which Richard Bartlett in Texas originally innovated with, he was actually called a charlatan. He was called a snake oil salesman. And the STOIC trial, prospective randomized trial, showed over an 80% reduction in hospitalization and death, a UK-based trial. We also use either prednisone or dexamethasone. We use colchicine, which is shown in the cold corona trial, over 4,000 patients, prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. In fact, cold corona is the highest quality trial that we have. We use full-dose aspirin, and then we get down to a next level in higher-risk patients. I have a patient right now I'm doing this on where we use low-molecular-weight heparin because we know it's a thrombotic illness. So in the UK, do doctors get roughed up if they start using inhaled budesonide, prednisone, low molecular heparin? Is it just as bad at that level?
I think if you simply take my case, where for the fact that all of my concerns that you saw in my video discussed with the NHS last year, okay, the problem for the NHS was that a million people were never meant to see my video. A million people were never meant to wake up. And the idea with me, I think, is to make an example of me so that every other doctor is too scared to prescribe what would be considered an off-label drug, and to continue with the vaccine rollout, which you and I both know is the toxin, okay? They're literally injecting the toxin. And for me, it looks like the very definition of an autoimmune illness, you know, that we're sort of storing up for the future with this
Okay, well, let's get into this now. So you and I agree early treatment works. There's a variety, maybe 4 to 6 drugs we can use in different combinations. Even if hydroxy and ivermectin are so controversial, we can treat the back end of the illness successfully. And sometimes I do. Sometimes patients call me so late, honestly, I really think it's beyond the reach of hydroxy and ivermectin, but they need steroids, aspirin, inhaled budesonide, colchicine, and anticoagulants. The ones who have O2 saturation dropping, that actually is microthrombosis. That is the sign that means anticoagulants. And I see people still fumbling with ivermectin at that level. I say, listen, get them on blood thinners. I just had a patient like this in Dallas yesterday. Now, the vaccines are interesting. So the vaccines, and all the world, in a sense, was suppressing early treatment or ignoring early treatment, really even ignoring in-hospital treatment and focusing on contagion control and rolling out the vaccines, like the vaccines were going to save us. And never have we had a prevalent illness where we tried to vaccinate right into the illness. And as they rolled out, we had these messenger RNA and adenoviral DNA vaccines, which were brand new novel technologies. Actually, previously, there was about 24 of them. They were basically designed to treat chronic diseases as gene transfer therapy or genetic therapy. And what was your viewpoint when they first rolled out and they opened up vaccination? This very first happened. From the very beginning, were you skeptical or did you think that it was a good thing for high-risk seniors?
No, way before then, because we were one of the first countries to roll out the Pfizer vaccine in December. And I said from then I wasn't going to be involved. But prior to that, I'd already looked at the trials of SARS-CoV-1 animal studies. And for me, that was enough to say, we've never made a successful vaccine for coronavirus. Why the hell are we rushing into this, you know, without animal studies? Why are we just saying the Nuremberg Code doesn't count anymore? That was enough for me, knowing full well that we had safe, proven, and cheap treatments. Why did we, with a failing health service, which is struggling for money all the time, need to invest in something potentially very, very dangerous?
Well, I was probably a bit more open to this as than you were. I testified in the U.S. Senate trying to break through to the American people about early treatment. I remember holding up my protocol. There's a lot of pictures that on the internet. I was suffering from COVID myself. I was recovering at the time. And we were asked as a panel at the very end, did we have any comments on the vaccine? It was November 19th. And our panel just was mum. You would say in the UK version of English, you'd say mum. We didn't say a word because it was by press release. And the thing that was odd to me is how infrequent COVID was in both the treatment and the placebo groups in the registrational trials for Pfizer and Moderna, less than 1%. How could they do a clinical trial and get less than 1% rates of COVID? But having said that, when they rolled out, there was such great enthusiasm. I thought, you know, for high risk seniors, maybe nursing home workers, we had clear cases of transmission to nursing home patients that they should receive the vaccine. But we started to see a signal in the U.S. and it emerged in terms of mortality on January 22nd. I didn't see it at the time, but we are following the data carefully, but I didn't see it. And if we would have had a data safety monitoring board, I'm sure they would have shut down the program in February. But clearly by March, I personally saw it. I was very uncomfortable. We had seen mortality go much higher than it should for a vaccine. And then all the alarms started going off. When did you think that mortality as a signal in the UK vaccine program got to a point where everyone should have been alarmed?
It doesn't seem that many people have been alarmed, which alarms me even more. We have a yellow card reporting system, which is similar to VAERS in the US. We've had about 1,300 deaths attributable to the vaccine and around 1 million adverse events. And we're a small country. And if we look at what Harvard have said recently, these reporting systems reflect a mere fraction of what is really going on. So we as a group of doctors have written to the chief medical officer to stipulate that it is a doctor's duty of care to always be filling out these yellow card reports based on suspicion alone. But for me, from the start, I was wary. We were also hearing that the spike protein mimics syncytin 1. So I was quite worried that they would be giving this to women who are pregnant, causing placental inflammation. And I believe that's reflected in a higher miscarriage rate now in countries where they have done that.
You know, in the United States, the consent form, I looked at the consent form at my hospital here in Dallas, there's actually a special paragraph. It says you have to check a box that you are not pregnant and you don't plan to become pregnant in the near future. So the consent form actually warns and consent form suggests that pregnant women should not get the vaccine. But yet, incredulously, pregnant women are volunteering and they're getting the vaccine in the centers. And you know, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology actually advocates the vaccine. It's never been tested in pregnant women. It has a dangerous mechanism of action. In fact, we have all reason to believe that it would cause harm to mom and the baby. We have every bit of biological concern there. And even the consent form tells pregnant women. And yet something seems to be off kilter. In pregnancy, we always assume that something is harmful until proven safe.
Yep. For any other drug, you would do exactly that. But it seems because there's been a pandemic declared, and again, we're talking about, from my point of view, a PCR pandemic, not a true pandemic. All of the things that we hold dear in medicine, like informed consent and how a trial should actually be conducted, have gone out of the window. Okay. And it seems to me that a lot of doctors, physicians, the regulators, they don't seem to mind. And if in this country you happen to speak out and say, hang on, we've got a problem here, you're the one who's ostracized, you're the one who's treated this way.
And let's just get back to safety for a minute. And just so you can understand our VAERS data, we're at over 9,000 deaths, over 21,000 hospitalizations, about 400,000 total certified safety reports. And we have actually an initial temporary VAERS number until the CDC vets what's going on. And that gets converted to a permanent VAERS number. So what I've just given the audience is a permanent VAERS number. I had a patient with clear-cut myocarditis in my office, this office that you're looking at here, just 2 weeks ago. I dutifully filled out the VAERS form. I entered in the troponin, the EKG values, where he was hospitalized, the heart failure medications this poor young man is on right now. And it took about 2 weeks, but I was called by an officer from the CDC and I reviewed the data with him. And, you know, he concurred. And I imagine this will be converted to a myocarditis permanent case in VAERS. We're over 2,000 cases of myocarditis. This predominantly happens in people under age 30 who don't need the vaccine, which is completely unnecessary. And now we're causing heart damage. We don't know if it's going to be permanent or not. We know about 25% of individuals have the beginnings of heart failure with left ventricular dysfunction and the signs and symptoms of heart failure. So what we're talking about here is a major biologic catastrophe. We have never had a biological product introduced onto the market that's had runaway mortality and hospitalizations. Very importantly, an analysis from McLachlan in London shows 86% of these deaths are actually related to the vaccine. A separate analysis from Rose and colleagues looking at temporal association shows that 50% of the deaths occur within 48 hours. They're strongly related to the vaccine. 80% occur within a week. People have actually used the term kill shots. And so what's happened in the United States, Dr. White, is that there's a term called vaccine hesitancy. Vaccine hesitancy has skyrocketed. And you know what? We don't need doctors to give the message. Patients are talking to each other. There's enough people who have died and have been hospitalized. They're seeing their family members die with the vaccine or their friends or people in their church or their community. And the vaccine centers are empty. I drove past our vaccine center today, as I always do. It's been empty now for months. They actually just put some barricades in front. There's basically nobody's even coming in anymore. We had a goal in the United States of achieving 70% vaccine rates by July 4th, our Independence Day. Yeah. And we're stuck currently at 48%. So America is amazing. It's always divided 50-50. And the vaccine programs on shutdown, they're starting to go door to door. They've announced that they're going to go door to door now and continue to promote the vaccine. Where do you think we're going on this? How can we have a biologic product that's strongly related to death? In fact, probably has killed so many thousands of individuals, landed others in the hospital, starting to have late neurologic, cardiac, immunologic, and thrombotic injuries to the body. How can this continue to go on without any check on safety? Where do you think in the end it's going to end up?
We have a slightly different issue here in that I think our media is far more heavily censored than yours. The fact that my story appeared in the Epoch Times and not a paper here speaks volumes. But my question really is, how many deaths is enough before we say we stop this altogether? And I think we've gone way, way beyond that point, not just in the UK, but globally. We've got enough data to say that the spike protein, which is coded within this vaccine, is the pathogenic determinant of what makes people sick. We've got enough data to say, halt this right away. And I don't see that happening.
Well, as you know, Dr. Tess Lowry and the evidence-based consulting group has a formal request into the MHRA to go ahead and shut down the program, that it's not safe for human use. We have citizens' petitions in from a doctor's group and nursing group to the center, to the US FDA,
to not approve these for use. And there's a very important paper by Bruno and colleagues, 57 authors, 17 countries, that calls for either immediate institution of risk mitigation and safety measures like a data safety monitoring board, human ethics board, and critical event committee. Otherwise, if they don't do this, which they should have been done from the start, to go ahead and shut down the program. So there's actually a broad call to shut this down. But what's your forecast? Is it going to be shut down, or do you think this is going to continue to march on?
I was privileged enough to go to a talk by Dr. Tesloro last week. And one of our priorities here is to make ivermectin available, not just for the vaccinated group, but the unvaccinated as well. And the vaccinated arguably could need it more. But I was hearing from her and from others that we are literally banging our heads against a brick wall. Now, I'm hoping that in the US, you will make progress in that regard. And as is usually the case, the UK follows your lead to some extent, because I don't think it's going to come from our government bodies, our regulators, to put a halt to this. They are pushing this vaccine like never before.
Well, there's no doubt about it. We think that we have all kinds of calls. We have some senators in Washington, as well as the Heritage Foundation, where I've made a presentation, basically capitulate and say that we've got the biggest biologic disaster in human history in terms of a biologic product. But we've had two presidential administrations behind it. We have the media are pretty much locked in on this. We have one major TV station now that is just wide open. And I know I'm a frequent commentator on Fox now, yeah, almost every night now, myself or one in our kind of group of concerned doctors is on trying to get the message to America in some digestible way that the vaccines simply aren't safe. And we now have data coming from the UK, the variant report, the 17th variant report that came out on June 25th, clearly showing 90,000 patients with the Delta variant, which is your predominant variant, will become our predominant variant. 90,000 patients, 42% are fully vaccinated, and so the vaccine has no impact now.
Yeah.
So the message now is the vaccine is not effective and it's clearly not safe, and we ought to shut this down. We feel that there's such malfeasance among our stakeholders. In the United States, it's the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, the FDA, and the vaccine manufacturers, that there's such malfeasance at such a high level that we can only take our message to the public. And the public, the will of the public, my body, my choice, is going to basically shut this down. That they push through 50% of the population. Most of my patients who took the vaccine did it patriotically. They thought they were trying to help the country. They were good people trying to do the right thing. But boy, Americans have paid the price. And it sounds like citizens of the UK have paid a tremendous price as well.
Yeah. And I should say, I'm usually a very private person, but the letter that was sent in my name to the head of the NHS, the head of the Metropolitan Police, Parliament, and the MHRA was a 23-page document, which hopefully you may at some point have time to read. But that was done as a public disclosure act to alert the public that we have a serious, serious problem here. It doesn't matter that my name might get dragged through the mud on this, because I'm sure that's what's going to happen. And they will label me, obviously, an anti-vaxxer. But you know as well as I do, this is in no way, shape or form a vaccine compared to any other. This is a toxin. Okay. And so the purpose of that letter, which fortunately was spread around the internet, was to alert the public, to alert the young people. Yeah.
Well, it's no doubt about it that, you know, historians will ultimately make the call here. And everything from, you know, Semmelweis and hand washing, where he was ridiculed and finished his life in disgrace, all the way to the first doctor who put a patient on the iron lung for polio, was thrown off of staff.
Yeah.
The real doctors who are going to be the real heroes of this crisis are doctors like Dr. Sam White and a lot of the hero doctors that are working together in these groups, C19 and FLCCC and Bird and Panda, Treatment Domiciliary, the COVID Medical Network. These are networks of hero doctors who are thinking clearly,
understand that this virus can be appropriately diagnosed in a narrow spectrum of people with symptoms. It can be treated early to avoid hospitalization and death, and that the vaccines, even if they were well-intended, the vaccines simply don't work well enough and they're not safe to promote in use. Dr. White, do you have any final comments for our audience?
No, it's funny that you should say I was thinking clearly, because the accusation from the NHS is that because of my video, I must be mentally unsound.
Well, I'll let that be your last word. And I'll just tell you, and to try to give you some confidence, I've looked the camera in the eye over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I've told the listeners, if anyone has any attack that they want to make, or they want to have any act of reprisal, bring it on. And I can tell you, not a single person has gone forward. I think there is a walk of shame that people are walking at this point in time. And there are colleagues that can't look me in the eye for their shameful behavior in what's happened in this pandemic. And so you are a beacon of light and a beacon of strength. And we know that we have the strength of the data. We have the strength of the will of the people, and we will prevail in the end. And those who are working to promote fear, suffering, hospitalization, and death, and now injure with the vaccine, those who are working to do that, they will see their day of justice.
I sincerely hope so. And as you say, we have all of the science behind us. So give me that day in court and I will bring the science with me.
All right, bring it on. I'll let that be the last word. That was Dr. Sam White from the UK. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is McCullough Report.
Five incredible years, and we're just getting started. Well, they say time flies when you're having fun. Well, it also flies by when you're on a mission of love. Love of country, that is. Well, our goal is to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. You can listen in on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. AmericaOutloud.com. It's a fight for the soul of humanity.
Get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I wanted to bring you a brief segment regarding COVID-19 vaccination in women's health. And I had a wonderful experience in the last few weeks where I visited the studios of Daystar, which is led by Marcus and Joni Lamb in Bedford, Texas. And I want you to hear just a couple segments that we had with respect to women's health.
There's a girl I know that does mammograms, and one of the questions she asks is, have you been vaccinated? And so a friend of mine was going to get a mammogram, and she asked her that question, and she said no, and she said good, and she said, why do you say that? And she said, because you can't believe what's happening to just the breast tissue of women who have been vaccinated. So my question is that spike protein not only affecting the heart, and you mentioned the ovaries, but other organs as well, and why?
It's probably local lymphatic spread. And in fact, our radiologists at our hospital learned that months ago, that where the same side where the vaccine goes in the arm, there's inflammation in the lymph system, and it distorts the breast tissue. So now we think women should not get a mammogram for a year afterwards. We've never seen this with vaccines before.
Now listen to this segment concerning the messenger RNA vaccines, nanoparticles, and the female ovaries.
And I didn't know this, that when they were designing this spike protein, they thought that it would just stay in the arm like other vaccines have done before. But you just pointed out that it's going all over the body. Why is it not staying localized, and why is that dangerous?
Because it's not in an oil, or it's not in anything that's going to make a deposit. These are lipid nanoparticles, and there were papers years ago suggesting when you inject lipid nanoparticles, they go everywhere. This is long before COVID. In fact, they tend to concentrate in the ovaries and the adrenal glands where lipid material is used to synthesize hormones. And the ovaries are obviously a hormone factory. And so lo and behold, during this application, we were told, oh, it just stays in the arm. That was the initial part of the package. And the Japanese, Pfizer told that to Japanese, and Japanese are interesting, they're not that trustful. They said, well, show us where it goes. Well, they did a biodistribution study, and through a Freedom of Information Act from Dr. Byron Bridle from Canada, he said, listen, I don't believe the Pfizer, show us where it goes. We got the data through that access, it's verified by scientists. The nanoparticles for Pfizer and Moderna, we assume now, get injected, they go through the body, the particles drop off the messenger RNA, they drop out except for in one place. They concentrate over 48 hours to a very high level in the female ovaries.
Oh my.
It's shocking.
And finally, listen to this segment regarding the COVID-19 vaccines and pregnancy.
You know, I have interviewed several doctors who have seen women who were pregnant who got the vaccine. Even one doctor that was 7 months pregnant in her 30s, that she got one shot, and that night she miscarried a 7 month old baby in pregnancy. I know of another nurse that nursed her baby. She was required to get the shot, and she nursed the baby, and the baby died from blood clots. They did autopsy. So what about pregnant women? What about women who are nursing? Why is this so dangerous? Does this go back to the spike protein?
It does, and I have to tell you, this is deeply disturbing. Doctors in my circles are wondering what has come over the minds of doctors and hospitals and healthcare systems. Pregnancy, we have classes of safety of drugs in pregnancy. We would never use a brand new drug in pregnancy, ever. A pregnant woman won't even have a half a glass of wine because she's worried about her baby. Why would she take an injection of brand new, unproven genetic material in her body? The FDA, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J excluded pregnant women and women of childbearing potential. Why? Because they knew what was dangerous in pregnancy. We never inject pregnant women with brand new, potentially dangerous substances. Now we know this goes in the body, produces the spike protein, it ravages the blood vessels, causes blood clotting. The New England Journal of Medicine published a paper of women who took the vaccine. And the paper was in a sense, made a completely incorrect conclusion. It said, well, safe in pregnancy. We said, wait a minute. They didn't follow everybody for 9 months. When we just look at who got injected where in the trimester of pregnancy, and this has now been, letters have been poured into the New England Journal of Medicine, first trimester of pregnancy, taking the vaccine, 83% fetal loss rate.
Oh,
it
terrible.
Is atrocious.
Oh, my
It's
goodness.
Absolutely atrocious. So there are stories all over of women at all taking the vaccine and then losing the baby. Why? They would never, if it was a new seizure medicine or new diabetes, we would never do this. Of course, pregnant women should never take the vaccine. Doctors should never, ever recommend the vaccine. And I predict doctors will do a walk of shame, a walk of shame of medical malfeasance and medical malpractice for recommending this. They need to come out of their trance.
Well, you can hear they really got me going on this. And I think it's terribly important to understand that pregnancy is considered a very, very special condition in medicine. No job is worth it. No school is worth it. And nothing is worth risking your health and risking the health of your baby to experimental COVID-19 vaccines that have really no opportunity for benefit. They are ineffective. They're generally not safe. And many believe should be off the market. You can't be forced into taking those. And for you, and for so many of us, the vaccine is the line. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.